Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm your guest host, Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith. Later this hour, we'll explore the fascinating world of shamans with anthropologist Manveer Singh. His new book explores the origins of shamanism and delves into its relevance during current times. But first, I wanted to introduce myself again. I'm Allison Briscoe-Smith. I'm a child psychologist and I'm a mom. And starting tonight, I'll be joining you here on the State of the Bay from time to time. I'll be hosting conversations about parenting and what it's like to raise kids in these complicated times. And how can we support both them and ourselves along the way? And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about parenting right now? What's keeping you up at night? We want to help. So let's get right to it. Even though we are just at the start of the school year, I was talking to another mom who said, "I'm already over it. I know that feeling of being done and overwhelmed. So overwhelmed by the news about what's going on in our world and the reminders that our children are growing up in a world where all types of violence and catastrophe is not rare, but routine. And I know I'm not alone. Parents ask me all the time, what do I say to my kids about climate change, about mass shootings, about war, about deportations, about so many things? And I have to be honest, sometimes I do feel discouraged. I feel worried that nothing I say or do will help me or my kids navigate the hatred and violence that might be coming their way. But hey, that's my job. I'm a parent, and no one ever said it would be easy. And what better way to confront an issue so tough than by facing it head on, by talking it out with other parents and experts? So that's what we're gonna do today. We're gonna dive into how we can help our kids and ourselves when we're struggling to make sense of the world around us. Joining me tonight for this important conversation are two amazing women and psychologists who know something about having tough conversations with kids and adults. They've co-authored the book, It's Time to Talk and Listen, How to Have Constructive Conversations About Race, Class, Sexuality, Ability, and Gender in a Polarized World, which has served as an amazing resource on how to engage in effective, compassionate discussions on tough topics. Dr. Anastasia Kim is a cognitive behavioral therapist whose primary areas of interest are children, adolescents, families, and organizations as well. Welcome to the State of the Bay, Anastasia.
Thanks so much, Allison. Good to be here.
And Dr. Alicia Del Prado is an award-winning psychologist who specializes in helping professionals, parents, families, and organizations on all kinds of topics. Welcome, Alicia.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here too.
And we also want to hear from you. Have you ever struggled with how to talk to your kids about scary, confusing, or upsetting news? Give us a call at 866-798-8255 or email us at stateofthebay@calw.org or find us on social media. So I want to get us kind of started. We're just coming off of listening to the news, and I just want to turn to you both. And starting with you, Anastasia, how are you doing? How are you managing talking to your own kids or the kids that you serve about all the things that are going on?
Ooh. Well, I, in coaching and working with parents and also in trying to encourage myself, I go and I've adopted a 24-hour cycle. If I think about this for the rest of the year or rest of the week, frankly, it's very hard to not drown in the overwhelm. So I invite myself to do the very best I can within a 24-hour cycle, get up tomorrow, and try to do it again. And this is actually what I bring into the consulting room with parents too. So for me, it's less about really the what and more about how and why I show up.
All right, so we're already getting concrete tips, 24-hour cycles. Alicia, what about you? How are you kind of managing this as a person, as a mom, also as a clinician?
I love that 24-hour idea. I'm going to write that down, Anastasia. You know, similarly, I feel like the concept of time is something that I am thinking through a lot. In a time where just the pace of everything, the pace of the news, the pace of life feels like just a rush, and honestly, sometimes very chaotic, I'm kind of giving myself permission and also encouraging my clients to have the power of pause, to be able to pause, even if there's tons of stuff coming at us. And through that pause, maybe taking a deep breath, maybe counting to three in our heads, it really does allow a reset for me, and I think others, to respond rather than to react to all the things coming at us.
So again, I'm hearing great kind of advice about how we try to kind of manage the kind of onslaught. But let's actually talk about that, both kind of clinically or the things that you're kind of seeing as you're serving kids and families. Are there big kind of questions that are coming up? Alicia, let's start with you. Are there big questions that parents are asking for help with?
Yeah, definitely. I think a common theme I'm getting from parents is what I'm doing or saying okay. So I think there tends to be a lot of self-doubt naturally. And I think on one hand, that humility of I don't have all the answers, I don't discourage that. But I also think that a lot of the work that I try to do with parents is helping anchor themselves in kind of their own truth and agency and their own values, so that when they're guiding their children, when they're feeling like they're stressed out or don't know what to do, to kind of go back to that as a compass when figuring out their kids. And as for those of us that may have more than one kid, it's not the same with each child either. So that adds to the complexity as well.
Anastasia, what are the questions that are coming up for you clinically and also as a parent?
You know, I see kids in elementary school, middle, high school, and college students as well. And it's all kinds of stuff, near and far, personal and global threats that are near and threats that seem far away, but still feel very proximate. And underneath all of that really is worried, worries. We're worried. I worry. I come from generations, at least three generations of worry warts. I birthed some worry warts. I'm surrounded by worry warts. We worry about everything. My elementary school age parents are worried about, are my kids getting along with other kids? You know, are these normal? They worry about whether what their kids are doing, how they're doing it, you know, is that normal? Are they okay? Is this weird, annoying behavior that I'm seeing now, is this going to go on forever? And they want some sort of guarantees. And underneath all of that are worries. Middle school parents, almost the same thing. We're in a new middle school. What do we do? You know, my child is protesting in X, Y, and Z's, you know, or they heard something in their middle school classroom about news, about a guest speaker that came. Should I ask them about it? Should I not? And of course, high school parents also sort of too, not just about the news, but about immediate worries, about friendships, about romance, about drugs, about influences, about social media use. What's on there? Should I follow my kids? Should I not follow my kids? And what about college? You know, do I hire somebody? Do I not? I mean, it's a tsunami of worries. And I am no different. and hence my 24-hour cycle. I try to, you know, I get overwhelmed, get swept under, and then have to reemerge after resetting. But worries, and they are a lot of legitimate worries. We hear a lot about, you know, the snowplow parenting, the helicopter parenting, the tiger moms. And yes, it's true. We are raising a generation of anxious kids. But if I'm being honest, I mean, there's a reason to be anxious. It's not like we're just making this stuff up, you know, and we're neurotic. I mean, I am neurotic, but we're not especially neurotic for constitutional reasons. There are so many reasons for us to worry. And so worry, I think endless tsunami of worries is, I think, what we all have in common.
That image is really profound. And I think it's one that probably really resonates, the tsunami of worries, all of it. There's also the piece that you're mentioning as well, which is, how do I know if my kids are okay? And there's almost been so much information about children's mental health and their wellness. It's hard to really calibrate, you know, is this okay? Is this a sign of worry? Alicia, I hear you actually offering, thinking about, well, what are our values? What are, you know, how do we get grounded? But how else are you kind of tackling this tsunami of worry?
Well, one of the things I feel really hopeful about, actually, and inspired by, is the amount of parents that are reaching out for help for their children earlier than at least in my career, I remember, even when behaviors aren't that outlandish, for example. So I have parents reaching out with kids as young as 7, and they're a little bit worried, and they're seeing mental health services as an option and as a tool, not something that is as stigmatized, I think, as maybe it has been in the past. Don't get me wrong, stigma's still there, but I really feel encouraged that parents are using that tool. And through that work, whether it's play therapy or other modalities that are kid appropriate, that the kids can work out their worries in their play or just saying it out loud to another trusted adult does wonders, even when there's so much chaos that we cannot control. In addition to worry, unfortunately, I am seeing more depression as well, though. Depression about, you know, do I want to live in this world where my communities aren't being welcomed? And that is painful to listen to hear our youth talk about that. And at the same time, so valid and so real. And similarly, when conversations are happening in the school setting about Palestine, about Israel, about Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, I really see young people struggling with this as well, especially when it connects to one of their identities. And so also kind of depression is accompanying around that those identities and those topics at times as well. So I think, and again, encourage having those safe outlets. Sometimes it's therapy, sometimes it's other spaces, but being able to be seen and heard, we cannot underestimate the value of that.
And so you're identifying that there's a reason for hope in this kind of reaching out. So we often hear in the news and we see, you know, the use of kind of mental health services by kids is on the increase. But there's a little bit of a flip that I hear you kind of saying, which is that, yes, this perhaps is an indicator of distress, but it's also an indicator of the savvy, the resilience, and perhaps the hopefulness of parents reaching out to try to get help. And so I want us to kind of lean into that again, because it's really easy for us to get overwhelmed with the news and to kind of interpret things as this is a sign of that the, you know, the sky is falling, although sometimes it feels that way. But Alicia, I'm hearing you kind of articulate something a little bit different, which is that this is actually people tuning in, listening, and trying to validate what's kind of going on with their kids. Am I getting that right?
Yes, I think it's both and from my perspective. You know, recently was contacted by some parents. They identify as immigrants, and they were really just kind of holding the complexity of the distress that they're experiencing and worried for their child, but also kind of seeing mental health services as a resource to get them through this time period. Mm.
Yeah, so this is another kind of strategy that we're really kind of leaning into. So we've already kind of talked about kind of trying to pause, trying to figure out what we think, but the asking for help is not a bad way of going. And we can even think a little bit about how do we ask for help, but it's okay for us to reach out. Again, not to be overwhelmed by this is just news and upticks in mental health. Maybe what we're seeing is parents actually trying to get resources and trying to get help, which is an important kind of step for us to really think about and to destigmatize, frankly. Ask for that help.
100%. And in the same example that I shared, I took the opportunity to say parenting's the hardest, right, and really validate what they were struggling with. As a parent myself of 2, it's real, and we don't need to have all the answers, but being able to ask for help, you know, to be in community, to have your villages, I think will help us get through.
Well, awesome. Well, we're going to go ahead and take a little bit of a little pledge break. It's pledge drive here at KLW. So we're going to take this break around asking for help and asking for resources. And we're going to go right on into that and come on back to answer some of your questions that have come in.
And thanks so much. You're listening to KLW San Francisco Bay Area. I am John Carroll. I'm asking for your support. You can call us right now at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can go online to kalw.org and click donate to make your gift of support. We are asking for your support. We're nearing the end of our fall membership campaign, where we come to you just a few times a year. This is one of those times, and we are asking you to support local community journalism like you're hearing right now. We want to hear from you. Hopefully you enjoy State of the Bay. You enjoy the stories that you hear. You learn something every time you listen, as I do. And I hope you are enjoying it enough to say, yes, I want to support you, KLW. I want to support you in all that you do, and I want to help support programs like this. So please call us right now and make your gift of support. It's very important that you do, because we are facing a federal funding cut. We've lost about $400,000 that we were expecting to get in October this year from the federal government, but that's now been cut thanks to the current administration. And so we are making that up, and we're asking you, family, to help support us and make that happen. 1-800-525-9917 is the number to call if you'd like to make a gift. You can do so for as little as $5 a month. Maybe you could do it for $25 a month. Maybe you could do $50. Whatever it is, please take this time right now. Make that gift of support. Make sure you commit to local journalism. Make sure you commit to factual reporting and all that goes along with it. 1-800-525-9917 is the number to call, or online at kalw.org. And thank you so much for your support.
This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW Bay Area. I'm your guest host, Dr. Briscoe Smith. And tonight we're discussing strategies for having honest, age-appropriate conversations to help children and us as parents feel resilient. And we're talking tonight with Drs. Kim and Del Prado. Anastasia, I want to come to you because we actually have some questions that have come in. We've been talking about asking for help and reaching out. So let's get you started with one of the questions that has come in. We've got an email from Jim in San Francisco who says, my sixth grader reads headlines, overhears things at home and at school, and comes to me worried, here's that thing, worried, about politics and topics like mass shootings, climate change, what type of world do we live in? How do I validate his concerns while also helping him not feel powerless or hopeless? Should I be trying to shield him more from the news? And if so, how?
Yeah. Well, thanks for that question, Jim, was it? I really appreciate that, especially the question of how do we do it? And I think that is really the most important way to orient to questions like this, whether we're talking about a sixth grader or a 16-year-old, is to simply sit down with your child, no matter how age, and then just ask. So often, because we are worried and we don't like our kids also worried or in a state of distress, little distress or a big sort of distress, we tend to have this impulse to make it right so that they feel better. And I want to encourage folks to really slow that down and just sort of sit with them, with our kids, and just ask questions. So more showing is so much more powerful than telling, and asking is so much more powerful than also directing. And so just say, what have you heard? How do you feel about it? What did you think? Like, when you read that, how does that make you feel? And part of what you're doing that is unspoken is to be able to tolerate the worry and the overwhelm. So again, showing and through experience is so much more powerful than like, Johnny, don't worry. That is not impactful. That's what we feel compelled to do. Allison, don't worry. Don't worry. All is okay. Don't read the news. Stop doing this or continue to do that. And as much as we feel that's our default for many of us, that's actually not part of best practices, is to sort of sit. And our kids begin to then tell us maybe some scary feelings and scary thoughts. And then we're going to again feel motivated to make it better. And that's another point to pause and resist that and just keep hearing. And in the process of hearing, and as you get not focused on the content, but really key on, zero in on how your child is talking about it, how regulated or not they are, and then show them. Not about the headline content of the headlines, but really show them how to take in some information. And of course, if your child is, consuming too much to a point where it's really not healthy, then we want to do some concrete things. But even then, if it's a opportunity to become co-architects with your child, like, wow, it sounds like, you know, what you're telling me is, then you read this and that, and you hear this and you seek this out, and that's making you feel really overwhelmed. Is that right? So even in that moment, when you see your kids doing something that's not as adaptive, you know, let them be leaders and let them be at the helm of noticing and being able to regulate their own emotions. So show, not tell, show, don't ask. Ask versus not telling, and really, you know, you using yourself, securing your oxygen mask first so that you could be modeling the kind of emotional regulation that our kids are constantly looking for.
You know, it's such a relief to actually hear that I don't have to have the right answer. And that's also the piece too. I think about that both as a clinician and also like as a therapist, like, do I have to have the right answer? No, I've been trained to ask good questions. And that's, I hear you, Anastasia, saying the same kind of thing, that we have to be able to listen to what's going on to our kids and what they're kind of saying versus then having the right thing to offer them. You and Jim also talk about this kind of tension though, about taking in so much information, you know, so many different sources, whether it's the screens or the radio, or even, you know, I don't know, do people watch TV anymore, but they're getting a lot of those kinds of pieces. A lot of the kind of questions that we kind of get is this tension between protecting and preparing. And so Alicia, I wanted to have you talk a little bit, maybe specifically with like taking in news. How do you think about protecting and preparing? Where is that kind of, is there a line? How do you think about that?
Totally. It's so tough. And I have a sixth grader. So I was thinking about my sixth grader as well. And, you know, I think that part of it is we're trying to teach our kids to generally how to consume technology too, like teach them skills to also be able to kind of manage what comes in and out. I'll give just some examples from my home where, and it is a lot of trial and error. So when I'm trying to manage screen use, whether it's iPad or for my older child's cell phone, you know, we will do the little kind of box where everybody puts their devices in at certain points. I thought it was clever. I called it cell phone nap time, and they put it in there. My kids did not think it was as funny, but it gave me some amusement, so it was worth it. So there's times like that where it's like, yes, I'm trying to protect, you know, especially with neurodivergence, that overstimulation, those dopamine hits, I think do need to be proactively monitored. And so, you know, no matter where on the continuum our children are at with that. And so from my perspective, it's like, yes, having some guidelines, some rules of when, you know, the devices go to bed, when there's breaks during the day are important. And of course it depends household to household, but that's kind of what I tend to advocate. But then also, you know, following up on what Dr. Kim was saying, being able to ask questions, because not all children metabolize the imagery the same way. So for example, you know, for some kids, the image is haunting them. The headlines are keeping them up at night, and other kids are brushing it off, and it's not it being internalized as a stressor or a trigger. So how are we supposed to know? I think that first kind of asking them, so what's so upsetting about this? You know, in an empathic, in a curious way, so our kids hopefully feel capable and motivated to tell us, because then I think once we can map out what's happening, then we can also further assess, like, okay, is this a way to help my kid not get stuck in the thought traps? For sure, there's real threats out there. However, if they're catastrophizing, if they're mind reading, if they're jumping to conclusions in ways that aren't actually helping them in their day-to-day life, then I can intervene that way. And or depending on what they answer, it might be more like a guideline or kind of generating a family rule. Kind of coming up.
You're both talking about the things that we can offer our kids in terms of asking questions or co-regulation or getting curious. And you've also both talked about the importance of our own kind of emotional regulation. Lisa, you talked about, catastrophizing. And I would say that actually I have Olympic gold medals in making mountains out of molehills. Like I myself can go really fast. I'm worried, as are many of the other parents. Anastasia, you talked about the kind of worry. So how much of this is actually predicated on us as parents? Not being, is it that we have to be not anxious at all? Do we have to be like super zenned out? How do you actually think about what you're actually saying that parents are going to have to do? Lisa, do you want to start off?
Totally. Well, I'm a former worrywart as well. I think. However, I will say that I think it's, again, both. So we don't want to gaslight our kids. I don't. I want to be real and be genuine and be able to say, yeah, I'm freaked out about that too. Or gosh, that gives me a pit in my stomach, or, you know, I'm feel really discouraged about the state of things. So I think being able to be real, however, hopefully not using our kids as the outlet for us. I'm calling one of you to be real. And tell you, you know, how dysregulated I am. And then going to my kids to be able to be honest. And then so that I can kind of be their container.
Awesome. So I just want to say again at the top that this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KLW Bay Area. I'm your guest host, Allison Briscoe-Smith. And tonight we're discussing the strategies for having honest and real age-appropriate conversations with our children to help them feel better, but also about us as well. We'd love to hear from you. So what questions or concerns do your children have about the world? How do you approach difficult conversations at home? What has or hasn't worked for you in helping kids process challenging news? Go ahead and give us a call now at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. Anastasia, there's another kind of question that kind of comes up that I'd love both of you to kind of weigh in on while we're still kind of thinking about how do we take care of ourselves in this. We've got an email from Nancy in San Francisco. She says, my husband and I have very different approach to how we should parent our young kids around these issues. I'm inclined to be more protective. I worry about hearing some of these scary events could be scarring, but my husband thinks it's important to give them the full picture to better prepare them to face the world. Can you give us advice on how to reconcile these approaches and figure out what kind of information is right? I like this question in part because it's tapping into us again, us as parents, and I'd love to hear both of your thoughts about that. Anastasia, let's start with you.
Yeah, there is such a great question. I get this a lot in my personal life as well as parents coming in. We don't need to be the same to do what is right, you know? And what is right really is, it depends on how old our kids are, depends on who our kids are, depends on what type of sort of situation. So if we could move towards more flexibility, in terms and sort of different approaches. So it's both, and I think Alicia mentioned this, it's protection and preparation. It's hard and soft. It's like self-guided and directed sort of like by us. So I think somewhere between what Nancy and her partner, what they're sort of doing is, if you will, quote unquote, the right one. But how do we tap in to that? I hear my kids all the time, and I'm sure your audience members, including Nancy, like, I know enough that if I go to mom at this particular hour, at this particular, she's going to say yes. And then I'm going to go to my dad and then tell him, yeah, she said it was fine, you know, or not go at all. So the kids also know that they're dealing with two different people. And that's who we are. We're two different people. And the invitation is for us to really think about not how to reconcile differences, but how to work with differences. Because differences mean that we have a multitude of varied approaches, and in that is an opportunity for all kinds of, more flexible approaches. And that's what our kids need. You never get to a place where you're like, okay, now I've reached a particular state and I could cruise. No, you know, maybe you found a Zen place in terms of how to parent, but then your kids just switch up on you. And what worked last year doesn't work anymore, you know, or what worked beautifully with one child, you know, doesn't work at all. Like nothing that worked with the first child worked with the second child. So being flexible and inviting differences, inviting opportunities to try on things that are not my preferences or my default, or and a part of my own unresolved anxiety and maybe sort of trauma, that's okay. So I think the name of the game here is to be able to embrace and practice within ourselves imperfection, to practice discomfort, to practice uncertainty. And if we can do that for ourselves and secure our oxygen mask as a practice on a 24-hour cycle for myself, then our capacity to be able to do it and hold space for our kids is just that much better.
Alicia, what do you think about this kind of both the kind of couple come together, but also as Anastasia is kind of hitting on, you know, the ways in which we can kind of try to resource ourselves in this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it's an opportunity to model to our kids when we disagree with important people in our lives. And hopefully if we're coming from a kind of regulated place, we can say, you know, I hear what the other parent is saying. I hear what mom is saying. I hear what dad is saying, you know, whatever the other parent goes by, I hear what they're saying. And you know what? Gosh, for me, it's different. And so being able to model like that, I think is really ideal and powerful for our children. And there's also some literature that says if we prepare our children within the home that racism is there, that sexism is there, that homophobia is there, and our children are aware of these things, mass shootings as well, and we're there to answer their questions, to explain our thoughts and feelings and family values about them, that they tend to experience a bit of a buffer when or if, unfortunately, those things are targeted at them. For example, the racism or witnessing things as well, violence, et cetera. Doesn't mean they're not going to be negatively impacted or hurt. And it's very hard as parents to not protect in that way. At the same time, I did want to make a plug for that, that those kind of conversations in the home can help.
And that's also an invitation for us to practice and to think about it. It's great advice to have, that actually having these conversations in the safety of our home. I often talk with parents about, look, do you want your kids to learn how to cross the street when they're at the corner with folks that are running? Or do you want to have talked about it before? Do you want to tell them to anticipate that the street is kind of coming? That those are our options, because they're going to learn about it. There's going to have literally some homie on the streets is going to tell them, or they can hear about it from us. And so those are the kind of opportunities that you both are really kind of talking about. So I want to thank you both so much for this conversation and coming to this space. We really have appreciated your comments and your sage advice. So I want to thank you to Dr. Anastasia Kim, and thank you, Dr. Alicia Del Prado, for coming to this space and helping us out. So we'll give you kind of our own round of applause and thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and just kind of think a little bit about where we've kind of been and how we have been thinking about this a bit. So we hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and that actually I'm gonna be back in the coming weeks to cover more parenting topics. So coming up after the break, we're gonna hear Grace Wan's interview with anthropologist Manveer Singh. So stay with us.
And you're listening to KLW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm John Carroll. I'm here in the middle of our fall membership campaign to ask you for your support. We want to thank a few folks who've already made their gift of support. We want to thank Leslie Rome in Oakland and Moana Luna and Kari Kiernan in San Francisco. Thank you both for your gift of support. You can make a gift as well and join the KLW family by calling us at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or go online to kalw.org. and click donate. You can gift for as little as $5 a month. Perhaps you can make it $50 a month, or maybe even $500 a month. Whatever is in your budget, you make the decision, but please take this opportunity right now and support your local public radio station. Right now, monthly donations to KLW's are vital to our future and the future of local journalism. As you may have heard, KLW and public media organizations across the country have lost our federal funding, and these cuts will take place in October, and they've already have immediate and long-term consequences for our service and to our local community, so we need to replace that funding with support from our audience. So now more than ever, listener support is crucial. And it's crucial to KLW, so please start your first ever monthly donation, or if you can, add a few dollars to your current monthly donation. So for perhaps you're doing 15, maybe you could go to 20. Whatever you can do, it is greatly appreciated. 1-800-525-9917 is the number to call, or go online to kalw.org and click donate. And thank you so much for your support.
I'm Grace Wan, and this is State of the Bay. During uncertain times, people reach for explanations and tools. Our guest today believes that understanding shamanism, past and present, could be instructive to facing this historical moment. Dr. Manveer Singh is an assistant professor of anthropology at UC Davis and author of Shamanism, A Timeless Religion, a book which came out earlier this year. Manveer Singh, welcome to State of the Bay.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Grace.
So, let's start out with something very basic. What is shamanism?
So that is a question that has been debated for more than a century. The way that I define shamanism is on the basis of three traits. It's a practice in which a specialist A enters non-ordinary states, sometimes called trance or ecstasy or altered states of consciousness. B, in those states, is understood to engage with some kind of unseen reality, gods, spirits, ghosts, ancestors, what have you. And then C, uses that engagement to provide a service, most often healing and divination, but maybe also helping predict the weather, helping economic success, inviting animal game, almost exclusively dealing with uncertainty in some kind of way.
You know, we have this view of shamanism as very primitive, and you describe it as a cognitive technology. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, the stereotype that you're describing is incredibly common, and this is the one that I had before I started studying shamanism, this sense that shamanism is archaic or exotic or confined to far-off societies. But an argument that I want to make is that shamanism is this hyper-compelling technology, essentially, that humans recreate incredibly reliably wherever they go to deal with uncertainty. It's been very easy for people to say, like, you have Amazonian shamanism and Siberian shamanism, perhaps even Korean shamanism, but they've been quick to separate out, say, Pentecostal pastors or the Hebrew prophets. It's very hard to justify this distinction. It's very hard to separate off the Oriental and the archaic and keep the Western and modern in a distinct category. And instead, I think all of these are reflections of this way that humans try to deal with uncertainty by looking to essentially miraculous kind of prophetic figures who can deal with the forces that are believed to oversee uncertainty in our lives.
It's so interesting to me because talking about uncertainty, that feels like today. And there is such an interest in shamans. We've kind of incorporated this idea in our modern life, and it's not quite the other, and yet it is, because people just don't seem to know what the future holds.
For sure. I think you definitely see a growing interest in shamanism. You also see this paralleled in interest in astrology and something like witch talk, paganism. According to the UK Census in 2021, shamanism was the fastest growing self-reported religion in the UK. And I think a big part of it is what you're describing, that we live in uncertain times, that there's just so much flux that there is a very powerful draw or allure of these practices that have been around for so long, which have this very strong kind of cognitive magnetism. I also think you have a growing turn away from institutionalized forms of religion, from institutionalized Christianity or different traditions that people grow up in. And it's not that when people turn away from these, they necessarily become atheists. They still have a strong spiritual hunger in many cases. And so these more informal, non-institutionalized practices, which are often more experiential, more ecstatic. You can see this in census data, where you have a reduction in people who describe themselves as spiritual and religious, but that's partly compensated by people who call themselves spiritual but non-religious, SBNRs, and they are really turning to a lot of these like more pagan and esoteric and shamanic techniques and practices.
No, SBNR is such a sad acronym for what they're trying to be.
I know.
Well, you come up through this. You are a professor of anthropology, and you spent 10 years studying the shamanistic practices of an indigenous group in Indonesia. What drew you to that group, and what is interesting about that group's use of shamanism? And I'll let you pronounce the name of the group so I don't get it wrong.
So I pronounce their name Mentawe. That's kind of halfway between what they say. They call themselves the Mentawe, and then Westerners call them the Mentawais. So I prefer something much closer to how they describe themselves. I originally decided to go work with the Mentawe, or at least visit their communities, because I was interested in indigenous religion and also indigenous systems of justice. So how do people manage conflict? What are local ways of enforcing rules? I was especially drawn to the Mentawe because they have this very strong indigenous religion. So the Mentawe live in Indonesia. They inhabit this archipelago at the west coast of Sumatra. And so my first summer, these figures, the shamans, they're called Sikere over there, really had a kind of social gravity. And on the one hand, they are very visually salient, and this is kind of part of the social and public identity. So they often wear loincloths, they grow out their hair, they tattoo their bodies. During ceremonies, they cover themselves in turmeric. And so they're very visually salient. It's almost like a mini celebrity when they're around. You know, they walk into a room and you can feel the room bend towards them. Mm-hmm. And so that was very salient. But then I also started to recognize that they were at the nexus of so many domains of life, of medicinal life, of ritual life, of political life, of justice. And I also started to see glimmers of this very intriguing and powerful experiential world. You know, I would hear their songs, I would hear them clanging bells. I hadn't really observed a ceremony in depth that first summer, but I saw a lot of glimmers of it. And so I came home and I was incredibly intrigued and curious about what I had seen there, how to understand it. And I started to read more on shamanism, and I realized that a lot of what I had seen that was very salient and striking actually echoes in many cultural contexts very reliably across societies. They develop these traditions in which you have practitioners who mediate between the human world and the non-human world, and use that mediation to deal with the most important domains of uncertainty, illness, weather, economic success, hunting.
Mm. Well, you know, we were talking earlier about the ways in which our culture can other shamanism, and yet there's a lot of cultural practices that we have, religious and otherwise, that seem to mirror shamanism. And you wrote a piece about how the far right definitely has shamanistic ideals. And when you were describing these shamans in Indonesia, the certitude and gravity they provided, I mean, Donald Trump does that for a lot of his own followers, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump is, of course, a fascinating figure and can be analyzed in myriad and endless ways. But one thing that I have found really striking is this parallel that you see between Donald Trump and a particular class of shamans. These are what we might call messianic shamans. These are these individuals who not only deal with illness, but then they also promise social upheaval, transformation. You find these figures very reliably across cultures. They often start out as shamanic figures, but then leverage their special status to promise renewal, often a renewal that is both backwards looking and utopian. So you often actually find it in the context of colonial encounters. So you have a colonial power that comes in, there's a lot of disruption. And so there is a wish to both go backwards, but also reap the rewards of whatever the colonial power has. So a classic example are what are called these so-called cargo cults that you found in Melanesia, where you have these figures who emerge and they promise that we will clear the land of the Europeans, but we will also bring back the dead. We will enjoy the fruits of capitalism. We will have the goods. You find similar things in South Africa, in Uganda, in China. One thing that is striking is the ways in which Donald Trump and a lot of the imagery surrounding him parallels these figures. So, you know, you are feeling disenfranchised, powerless, marginalized. And the reason is this group, often a powerful group, the other, and they are not only powerful and the cause of your misfortune, but they are morally abhorrent. They have sex with children. They eat babies. They conspire in graveyards.
Yes.
I remember during my PhD doing a systematic project on depictions of these witchy enemies across cultures, and QAnon was arising. And just the extent to which QAnon is just one of these kind of classically witchy narratives is incredibly striking. So you have the cabal, you have the existential threat, and you have the moral abhorrence. You have these three central features that are so common in these movements. And then you also have the messianic figure who co-evolves with them, who promises that they are exceptional in precisely the ways necessary to vanquish that figure. You know, there's so much analysis about Donald Trump, but one thing that I think is sometimes missing is the ways in which this dynamic that we see unfold is an echo of a dynamic that has occurred cross-culturally and ubiquitously between the shamanic messianic prophet figure and the cabal that he conjures up.
I mean, because I think when you're studying shamanism, you're really trying to understand how we collectively as humans respond to the events around us and are seeking out through lines. Like, this isn't new. When humans don't know what's happening, when they're afraid, they often look to a person of authority and they look to an outside other who's responsible for the pain and the fear that they're feeling. As an anthropologist, I think you might say a pattern that's familiar.
For sure. But I think by studying them and engaging with them with respect and trying to understand how they exist in their context, I mean, there's this classic phrase, this aphorism in anthropology, it makes the strange familiar and the familiar strange. The shaman becomes a figure that is much more familiar, much more comprehensible, while the things that surround us, that we take for granted, that we maybe consider paradigms of Western exceptionalism become framed in a much more cross-cultural lens. We understand them not as like quirks of modernity only, but as reflections of this pan-human tendency. Something else that I talk about in the book are money managers. So there's a lot of this question of what are the modern shamans? And I don't think money managers are technically shamans, but I think they're shaman analogs. They're individuals who promise control over a very chaotic and probably uncontrollable or unpredictable system. They're often literally promising to forecast it, to divine it. And then as they compete amongst themselves, they build these personas that are very compelling, that are very charismatic, and that promise their clients that they can deal with these forces of uncertainty. Obviously, they're not entering trance. They're not talking to gods. But there is an...
That we know of, Manveer.
Yeah, right.
You know, and we, similarly to the tech people that we offer a lot of adulation and praise to, you know, they're helping us decipher and create worlds that we don't understand. So they're gurus, they're wizards, they're, you know, we use those terms that I think come from shamanism to describe these modern day leaders.
For sure. And one thing that I have found very striking is actually the extent to which they draw on practices and techniques that are themselves very shamanic. So one example is just this fascinating focus on deprivation that you find among tech CEOs. I remember Elizabeth Holmes, who famously started Theranos and then had I think she's still in prison, but was claiming to subsist on green juice, on something that is like actually impossible for a person to nutritionally subsist on. And you find this real insistence on intermittent fasting, on people who are claiming to eat one meal a day or not eat several days a week. And that is actually something you find near ubiquitously among shamanic traditions, the sense that through deprivation, you cultivate special powers, that it promotes the sense that you are different from normal humans, that you have these special abilities. They are trying to convince people that they are near miraculous, that of the many people who are competing to produce a company that can be worth billions of dollars, they are the individual who has that special sauce.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. It's like the cold plunge. Jack Dorsey, I think, famously went on a very strict diet. He was one of the creators of Twitter. I mean, you make so many good analogies to that. I find it fascinating.
Right, the infrared heat lamps, the weird tweaking of the eyes, superhuman.
I just, reading through all of this, I couldn't help but think of that Jay Sixer who had the buffalo head on in search of the Capitol, because it's just that seemed like his version of what a shaman would be and should be. But to ask you, Manveer, does it bother you that people in our culture are relying on shamanism or shamanistic practices to lead us, to show a path forward? Or do you think that's just the way we humans are? We fall upon known patterns and ideas.
Yeah. On the one hand, as an anthropologist and as an observer of human culture, there is a part of me that sees it from this more ethnographic and observational perspective. On the other hand, I think that the features of shamanism and shamanic practices, like all technologies, can be used for good and for bad, that they're in themselves morally ambiguous. So on the one hand, I think it can be used for exploitation. It can have obvious harms. On the other hand, in the book, I write about how I think shamanism is also, insofar as it's often used for healing, also potentially a very powerful tool for therapeutic healing. I mean, what's at the center of shamanism so often is a really powerful experience that can allow you to change your story about yourself. You know, you come in, you feel a particular way, the shaman, and you like co-create a narrative about why you're feeling that way. But then through this very powerful experience, you can change that narrative about yourself. You can feel liberated. You know, I think shamanism can also induce powerful placebo effects. I think it can be a source of community and connection. So I think it's complicated.
There is so much more to delve into on this topic. It's fascinating. And I wanted to thank you, Dr. Manvar Singh, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at UC Davis, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Grace. This was so much fun.
Manvar Singh is the author of Shamanism, A Timeless Religion. Definitely worth picking up at your independent bookstore. Quite a read. I'm Grace Watt, and this is State of the Bay.
That was certainly a fascinating segment. And well, that's State of the Bay for this week. Join us again next week to hear Shoshana Walter talk about her new book, Rehab, An American Scandal. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit State of the Bay page at klw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email at us at stateofthebay@klw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Heather Hughes. It was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and Dee Biner was our board operator. Stay tuned to hear an episode of KLW's podcast in residence, Not Born Yesterday. I'm Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith. Good night, and thanks for listening.
And thank you. We are here in the midst of our fall membership campaign, and I'm John Carroll. I'm joined in studio here with producer for State of the Bay, Chris Nooney. Hi, Chris. How are you this evening?
Hi, John. I'm doing well, thanks.
We are, Chris has been producing State of the Bay for, what, 15 years now?
Maybe 10 years. 2015, 10 years,
so 10 years, wow, it's a long time.
Yeah, and it is a long time.
What drew you to the... to actually do this? Why do you think this show is an important part of the schedule here?
Well, I just think that local journalism is so important. I was really drawn to the opportunity to be able to tell stories about the Bay Area where we live, and maybe stories that other news organizations aren't telling, or maybe from an angle that other news organizations don't have. But, you know, we're a call-in show, and mm-hmm. we love to hear from our listeners. And so we'll get ideas for them, and we'll, you know, friends who know I produce are always giving me ideas. It's really wonderful to be a part of the fabric of the Bay Area, which KALW definitely is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to think of another station where a show like this would get an opportunity, because, you know, there are so many different competing times and priorities and things, for especially for stations if they have specific, you know, like for a commercial station, if they have corporate overlords that are like, yes, you're only going to cover these sorts of topics and you're only going to do these kinds of things, which is not unheard of these days. I think the great thing about for KLW is the fact that we have an editorial independence here, because we depend upon our listeners for the support that we need. And so I think that gives us a little bit more leeway to actually try to do things and to work in a way that is more responsive to our community, and to be super local, as well as have the engagement to do the kinds of shows like State of the Bay. And if you are listening and you've want to support this kind of work, then you can call us at 1-800-525-9917 or go online to kalw.org and click donate. You know, as we said, the show you just heard, State of the Bay, was produced through local folks here in the community. It's also produced through the power of listener support that's powered KLW for more than 80 years now. And beyond your membership, you have the chance to help create something new, to create future programming and continue the work that we're doing like this. So, Chris, what would you say to people if they're waffling about whether to donate or not?
Oh, please. Your donations are so important. It doesn't matter what amount you give. We appreciate whatever you are able to give. Again, this is we love this work. It's important work, but we need your support to be able to continue it. So please just think about the stories that you've heard, that you've loved, and, you know, hopefully you can show your love by just giving us whatever you can.
And you can show your love by calling us at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can go online to kalw.org and click donate. There's a big pink button in the upper right corner that you can click on. That will ask you for your name, your contact information, how much you'd like to give, and how. And that's pretty much it. It'll take you about 3 minutes. You can make a gift for as little as, you know, $5 a month. Maybe you can afford a little more. Maybe you could afford $50 a month. Maybe you could afford $100 a month. Whatever it is, please take this opportunity right now to join others in your community who are supporting this work. Because frankly, we can't do it without you. You are what powers everything here at the station. So please make your gift and be as generous as possible. 1-800-525-9917 is that number you can call. That's 1-800-525-9917, or go online to klw.org and click donate. And Chris, I want to give you the last word to make people do their what are you going to say to make them
know? Well, just, you know, we love the Bay Area, and we are a Bay Area show, a Bay Area station, so help us out and do what you can. Thank you.
There you go. You heard it. Thanks so much. We appreciate your support. KLW.org, click donate. We thank you so much.